Hello, my name's John Dennis. It's Thursday, January the 8th. Today, we look at how the United States' approach to the Middle East might change when Barack Obama becomes president in less than 2 weeks' time.
What he is now trying to do is sort of to come up with a way of dealing not just with this crisis in Gaza, but of retaining control over his entire agenda for the Middle East.
Also today, McDonald's is to become the UK's largest provider of apprenticeships. We hear from a worker who's completed the scheme.
I can work in kitchen now, which I never used to do before. I'm more confident in the kitchen as well. After the apprenticeship, I got my crew trainer.
And with temperatures below zero, the bill for cold weather payments to pensioners and vulnerable people has topped £100 million. But weather experts warn that because of global warming, the government may need to consider hot weather payments.
And this would obviously be for pensioners who suddenly had big energy bills caused by the fact that they had to have their air conditioning on.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But before we hear about any of that, the news headlines and a look at today's papers with Sandy Waugh.
Israel and Hamas are coming under increased pressure to come to a truce as fighting continues in the Gaza Strip. More than 60 airstrikes were reported by Israel last night, and rockets were fired from Lebanon into northern Israel, increasing fears the violence could spread. Today, a senior Israeli official will travel to Cairo to discuss ceasefire options. A Hamas delegation may also go to Cairo for parallel technical talks. Israel said it accepted the principles of a Franco-Egyptian truce proposal, which was backed by Washington, but wanted to see the details. US Security Council remains deadlocked over the crisis. We'll hear more on this from The Guardian's correspondent in Washington later in the programme. The government's denying reports it's considering printing more money as a tactic to tackle Britain's credit crunch. Treasury sources say that while the move has not been ruled out, it is not currently on the agenda. Yesterday, the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee began its two-day meeting to decide interest rates. It's expected to cut rates today, currently at 2%. That would mean rates at their lowest point in the bank's 315-year history. Russian and Ukraine gas executives are due in Brussels today to argue their cases in a gas price dispute that has choked off energy supplies to EU countries. Ukraine denies Russian accusations that it is stealing gas passing through export pipelines on its territory. Russia cut gas to Ukraine a week ago as a row over allegedly unpaid bills escalates. The EU depends on Russia for about a quarter of its total gas supplies, some 80% of which are pumped via Ukraine. The entire cabinet is in Liverpool for its third meeting to be held outside London since September. The visit comes during Prime Minister Gordon Brown's three-day regional tour to see how the country is coping with the economic downturn. Urban regeneration and capital spending programmes will be major themes when ministers gather in the northwest. The idea of holding cabinet meetings outside London has been criticised by the Conservatives as a gimmick. Pakistan has sacked its national security adviser as tensions continue between Islamabad and India over November's attacks in Mumbai. Mehmood Ali Durrani was officially accused of showing irresponsible behaviour and a lack of coordination on security matters. Islamabad's confirmed the only gunman to survive Mumbai is a Pakistani. This is the first time Pakistan has acknowledged any links to the gunman. Look at this morning's papers now. The Times and the Daily Mail say the Chancellor, Alistair Darling, is considering printing more money in an attempt to ease the credit crunch. The money supply could be expanded by billions, with extra cash used to buy assets ranging from government or commercial debt to private equities. Shoddy service and high prices are putting foreign visitors off coming to the UK, the government's tourist board is reported as saying in The Independent. The Daily Telegraph reports millions of savers who've invested in premium bonds have seen their chances of winning drop dramatically. The large cuts in interest rates have almost halved the total prize money available in less than a year. The Guardian predicts the wrangle over gas supplies between Russia and Ukraine will keep British energy bills high. The Financial Times reports that the Royal Bank of Scotland is discussing the sale of its £2 billion stake in Bank of China. And the back pages of most of the newspapers report on the resignation of England cricket captain Kevin Peterson and the sacking of Peter Moore as England coach. Andrew Strauss will take over as captain for the upcoming test and one-day tour of the West Indies. More of this later on Guardian Daily. More on today's stories and breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
President George Bush has so far endorsed Israel's action in Gaza. America's president-elect Barack Obama has sworn silence until he takes office on the 20th of January. But as our Washington correspondent Suzanne Goldenberg explains, for Obama, the Middle East will be a priority.
What he is now trying to do, I think, behind the scenes is sort of to come up with a way of dealing not just with this crisis in Gaza, but of retaining control over his entire agenda for the Middle East. He wants to make sure that when he does take power on January 20th, he is the one who is dictating what America's policy is going to be towards Israel and the Palestinians.
And that'll be a test for his relationship with his Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton.
Absolutely, but I think we are already getting indications right now that Hillary Clinton is a full partner in the decisions that are going to be made. There's a number of names in circulation right now for prospective envoys, these sort of series of regional envoys who the Obama administration is expected to appoint to deal with various key foreign policy issues, such as Iran, Israel and the Palestinians, and India and Pakistan. And the names that we're hearing are people who have served in Bill Clinton's administration. So I think we can assume from that Hillary Clinton is very much involved in these decisions.
Barack Obama, of course, he was elected on a platform of change. Well, will that extend to U.S. policy on the Middle East?
From what I'm hearing, we're going to see some changes right away. I think the Obama administration wants to go in and to send a signal to the world that this is a different administration. They want to sort of make some kind of gesture that will help repair America's image in the world, particularly in the Arab world and among Muslims, because that's where America's image has suffered the most damage under the Bush years. So I think that Obama realizes that he has to do something about Israel and the Palestinians. Behind the scenes also, I think there is a growing consensus among foreign policy figures here in Washington that the Obama administration cannot continue with the Bush administration's policy of isolating Hamas, that America and at some point has to deal with Hamas, not in direct talks, certainly not at this point of time, but there will be some kind of communication with Hamas, and there will be greater communication and cooperation, too, with European allies on Israeli-Palestinian issues.
Does that mean that the Obama administration will move further away from the Israel government, which Bush has very much sort of cleaved to?
I think that's going to be something more nuanced. American foreign policy towards Israel, it doesn't vary that much. America has always been the strongest supporter of Israel, and I don't think that Obama is going to change from that very much. Indeed, he has signaled that he will continue to be a supporter of Israel, but I think he believes that it is in the best interest of Israel and the region as a whole, especially in terms of countering the emerging threat of Iran, if there is stability and peace between Israel and the Palestinians. So I think that is the argument he's going to make. It's not about pressure on Israel. It's about stability in the region.
Suzanne Goldenberg in Washington. And there's full coverage of Gaza today and the diplomatic efforts to resolve the crisis at guardian.co.uk/Israel. Also on The Guardian's website, Oliver Berkman says farewell to Bush and remembers his best gaffes at guardian.co.uk/America. We've got video of Patrick Barkham visiting London Zoo for their annual stock take at guardian.co.uk/G2. And our art critic, Jonathan Jones, asks whether we need more capitals of culture. guardian.co.uk/arts. Cold weather payments to pensioners and vulnerable people are worth £25 a week this winter. That's three times as much as they received last year. With Britain shivering in a cold snap, the total bill for cold weather payments is rising by the day. But as our political editor Patrick Winter explains, because of climate change, the Treasury could soon need to pay out to protect people from warm weather.
What the Met did was they looked at summers such as those in 2003 and 2006, which were extremely hot and indeed led to some people dying, and they've come up with a proposal that the DWP may not need just to think about cold weather payments and the cost of them, but also about the prospect of having to introduce something new, which would be hot weather payments. And this would obviously be for pensioners who suddenly had big energy bills caused by the fact that they had to have their air conditioning on or something like that, and that the DWP, whose job is to look after the health and welfare of the elderly, will not just have to worry about people dying from pneumonia, but dying from heat exhaustion. Could end up being another big bill for the DWP and for the government.
Well, indeed. When would these warm weather payments kick in?
Well, this is very much a provisional piece of research which the Met has done. I think the DWP is currently scratching its head and thinking about it, but they may also at the moment be worrying more about people freezing and dying from cold rather than dying from heat exhaustion. But the there would have to be a sort of trigger point at which the temperature went over a certain level, and that therefore you'd have to bring in these hot weather payments to help people pay with their energy bills. I know the Met's done similar research for certain energy companies, pointing out that the kind of changes in demand that you see during cold periods may now switch to the summers. It may all be seem a long way off and may seem slightly inappropriate at the moment, but that's how these futurologists are looking at it.
And do they know how much it would cost?
Well, no, because it would obviously completely depend on at what level you set the benefit. I mean, the Gordon Brown, generously but perhaps foolishly, given the weather, has just increased quite substantially the cold weather payments to £25 a week when temperatures go below freezing in specific areas. And that bill is now rising, just for this winter alone, to over £125 million, and based on Met projections is going to be over £200 million. I think the weather that kicked in on Wednesday in London has led to another 600,000 people being eligible, and that's going to cost the taxpayer £15 million in cold weather payments. So if you had a terribly hot summer and you set the benefit at the high enough level, you could end up with big payments.
Patrick Winter. I'm John Dennis. Coming up in Guardian Daily, the Berlin Philharmonic performs online at a digital concert hall.
Now, in the comfort of my own living room, with just a few clicks on my computer, I can listen to and watch a whole season of concerts of a major orchestra. They are being broadcast live over the internet as high-definition video streams.
But first, the fast food giant McDonald's is to become the UK's largest provider of apprenticeships. 6,000 of McDonald's 72,000 workers will be trained this year, and from 2010, up to 10,000 a year will be offered the apprenticeship. It's a level 2 qualification in hospitality, a nationally recognised qualification accredited by City and Guilds, and it's the equivalent to 5 GCSEs grades A to C. 3,000 McDonald's workers have already completed the apprenticeship, which has been piloted in 80 restaurants. One of them is Alex Potts.
I had to work through a CDP, Crew Development Programme.
What's that? Sorry, for those of us that don't know.
Basically, there's three things you do in each section of your restaurant. There's quality, cleanliness and service. You have to do tests on all these. You have to do workbooks, and then you get the stars on your badge. And then that works towards your apprenticeship. And then I did my English and maths on the online site, on Our Lounge. And then I did my key skills as well.
And when this qualification was first sort of suggested, you know, what was it that appealed to you about it?
Well, when I left school, I didn't get very good grades. I didn't pay attention at school and messed around.
And so what has it led to now that you've got the qualification? What are you able to do that you weren't able to previously?
I can work in kitchen now, which I never used to do before. I'm more confident in the kitchen as well. After the apprenticeship, I got my crew trainer, promoted to crew trainer. So I trained all the new staff, did their health and safety verifications, did all their questions and tests and workbooks for their stars. And I went to the AGM in Prague, where all the business managers were. I got presented with my certificate, and then when I came back from Prague, I got my management development programme, and now I'm a training manager. So I've had 2 promotions and 3 pay rises in a year, whereas I've been there 6 years and it's all happened in the last year.
Well, congratulations with all that. So, but if you wanted to go and work for another employer, do you feel confident that the qualification that you've gained at McDonald's would be recognised by, you know, another employer?
Yeah, there's with it being multi-skilled and working with people and customers and working as a team, you can take it anywhere. There are specific bits that are just McDonald's, but a lot of it you can take somewhere else as well.
And so what would you say to people who, you know, may sort of dismiss it as a MOOC qualification or whatever?
I don't really know. People perceive it in a different way. They don't understand how much work goes into it. All the people at my restaurant, if they haven't got very good grades, I've told them to do it. You might as well do it while you're working and doing what you know and gain a qualification while you're doing it.
Alex Potts. Only 5 months after he was appointed, Kevin Peterson has stepped down as England's cricket captain. Peter Moores has been sacked by the England and Wales Cricket Board as England coach. Andrew Strauss takes over as captain for the upcoming Test and one-day tour of the West Indies. Peterson intends to be part of the playing squad. Our cricket writer, Mike Selvey, gives his reaction.
I'm surprised that Kevin Peterson's gone. I'm not surprised that Peter Moores has gone. But, you know, in a way, it's been presented as a crisis for England cricket, but actually it might prove to be the making of the side in an odd sort of way. I've always felt for a long time that the coach has been somebody who has not been able to take the team forward at all, and in some respects has gone back. The individual players haven't progressed under his coaching, and that's really the nub of what Kevin Peterson's been trying to say. He is, as captain's, felt like that his side hasn't been able to progress. He's been in a position to, he thinks, be able to say something about that. And the upshot of it is that the coach is gone and they will get a new coach. And I think that's probably the right thing to happen, and it's probably happening at the right time too. Whether Kevin Peterson's going is the right thing is another matter. What they'll now happen with Andrew Strauss as captain is they'll have a perfectly acceptable captain for their Test matches, but they won't either. They won't have a captain for one-day cricket or 2020 cricket, and they'll split the captaincy again, or they'll be carrying a passenger in the side, and that's not quite so acceptable, I don't think.
Do you think that the events of yesterday did much damage to the reputation of the English game?
Initially, that's how we view. That's how it might be viewed abroad. But actually, when you see the outcome, let the dust settle on it all. It's not been a nice spat, has it? It's been pretty unseemly. Much of it generated outside the remit of the two parties involved. Actually, you think about it, Peter Moores has not uttered a word on it. He's kept his counsel. And Kevin Peterson's really not had very much to say on this at all. The only words he's that are attributed to him publicly have been those in his newspaper column. Other people have had a lot of things to say on his behalf. Now, whether he could have done anything to stop that, I don't know. I don't think it was particularly wise that the whole thing was conducted while he, as England captain, was chasing animals in South Africa. I think, you know, it was a far too important issue for him to be stuck out there. I think he should have broken off his holiday and come back and sorted that out too. So that will be seen as bad. But when the dust settles and they see that actually they've got a new coach in place and, you know, there's been a lot of clamour to get a new coach, they'll get a new coach. And Andrew Strauss has done perfectly well as England captain in the Test side in the past, and there's no reason to suppose that he won't do a similarly sterling job in the future. Kevin Peterson has said that he's fully dedicated to carrying on batting for England. And actually, you think about it, this is Kevin Peterson's a bloke who's got his life mapped out. He knows exactly where he's going with his life. He's very, very focused on that, and very, very direct and quite ruthless in the way that he's done that. Well, I wouldn't mind betting. Even his wildest dreams, being captain of England, was not part of that plan. So actually, he was only sort of mildly deflected from his normal path. I think all that happened is he'll go back on the path he'd already decided he should be following.
Mike Selvey. The Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra has begun a series of online performances in what it's calling a digital concert hall. The first concert took place earlier this week, a performance of Brahms' First Symphony, directed by Sir Simon Rattle. Classical music fans can listen in anywhere in the world. Kate Connolly is in Berlin.
The 128 musicians who make up the Berlin Philharmonic tune up for one of their highly popular concerts. I'm sitting in the eighth row of their magnificent concert hall for a performance of Johannes Brahms' First Symphony. Tickets for the Berlin Phil are always hard to come by, particularly like tonight when Sir Simon Rattle, the orchestra's artistic director and chief conductor, is on stage. I'm lucky enough to be here in the German capital to experience them. But how about if I was a music student in New York, say, or a lover of Brahms in Nairobi, or simply sick and stuck at home? Well, thanks to some remote-controlled cameras and state-of-the-art technology, the Berlin Philharmonic is on the verge of expanding its audience from a few hundred to millions of music lovers around the globe.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the first live broadcast from the Digital Concert Hall of the Berliner Philharmonica.
Now, in the comfort of my own living room, with just a few clicks on my computer, I can listen to and watch a whole season of concerts of a major orchestra. They are being broadcast live over the internet as high-definition video streams, and I can either tune in live or choose to watch the concert at a later date, all for a modest fee. Critics say the introduction of the world's first digital concert hall will help ensure the future of classical music in the digital age. Any time, any place is the slogan. And Sir Simon Rattle is an enthusiastic supporter. Before the concert, he explained the importance of the project.
Well, I think it's very important for us. I think it's also the future. We have many friends worldwide. And particularly, we wanted the audience not only to be able to hear, but also to see what this orchestra does. We've all been talking together, even in the last century, about what it was to be an orchestra of the 21st century. And for these last 5 years particularly, we've been trying to think, how do we spread the message further? It's strange to remember that YouTube only started in 2005, but I think also seeing how that grew like the most wonderful virus on the net made us think that it was more and more important to reach people in different ways. The world is changing very, very fast, and people are going to want their culture and their entertainment in different ways. You know, we can reach people now at any time when they want to see us.
The Berlin Phil has a very loyal following, so in the foyer after the concert, I was keen to find out the audience's views.
Well, I think the concept is it's a great idea to have the possibility in the to go online and to, you know, to access the concerts and to have a look at them. But what I didn't really grasp was, do you have to pay for it? If yes, how much do you have to pay? How that really works, I didn't really understand. And if the quality is really that good, then I think it's a great idea.
The atmosphere of being live in a concert hall, can that be matched if you're sitting at home in your living room?
I don't think so, unless you have a brilliant stereo system, because I think that's the huge difference, is really the acoustics, if you're in a concert hall like this one.
Well, I think, too, that it's a very good idea to give everyone the possibility to listen to that wonderful music, and not everyone has the opportunity to go to the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra. So I think it's a very good idea, and it's time to start. And it's a good way to give everyone access to that kind of music.
Kate Connolly. Today's edition of Guardian Daily was produced by Peter Sale and Francesca Panetta. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.